From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the film classic West Side Story. This musical about rival street gangs in New York won 10 Oscars. We'll speak with two of the Oscar winners, George Takaris, who played the leader of the Puerto Rican gang, the Sharks, and Rita Moreno, who played his girlfriend, Anita. And we'll talk to Marnie Nixon, who dubbed the singing for Natalie Wood. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the lyrics of the Star Spangled Banner and other American anthems. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this edition, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the film West Side Story, the great musical about two rival street gangs in New York, the Jets, a white gang, and the Sharks, a Puerto Rican gang. The film was adapted from the Broadway musical, which opened in 1957. The music was composed by Leonard Bernstein, with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. From the soundtrack of the film, here's the Jets song.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet.
Now I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out, let's get cracking.
Where you gonna find Bernardo?
It ain't safe to go into PR territory.
We'll be at the dance tonight at the gym.
Yeah, but the gym's neutral territory.
Hey, Rab, I'm gonna make nice with him. I'm only gonna challenge him.
Great, Daddy-O.
So listen, everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony me at the dance at the 10. And walk tall.
We always walk tall.
We're Jets.
The greatest.
When you're a jet, you're a top cat in town. You're a gold medal kid with a heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swingin'est thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king. The Jets are in gear. Our cylinders are clinking. The Sharks will stay clear. Cause every Puerto Rican's a lousy chicken.
Here go the Jets like a bat out of hell. Someone gets in our way. Someone don't feel so well. Here come the Jets, little world.
The cast of the movie West Side Story recently celebrated the 40th anniversary with a reunion and screening at Radio City Music Hall. This Saturday night, Turner Classic Movies will show the movie, along with interviews with some of the film's stars. A little later on, we'll meet Marnie Nixon, who dubbed Natalie Wood's singing voice for the film, and Rita Moreno, who played Anita, the girlfriend of Bernardo, the leader of the Sharks. First, we'll hear from the actor who played Bernardo, George Takaris. He won an Academy Award for his performance. Here he is in the War Council scene, planning a rumble with the Jets.
We challenge you to a rumble. All out, once and for all, except...
On what terms?
Whatever terms you're calling. You cross the line once too often.
You started it.
Who jumped Baby John this afternoon?
Who jumped me the first day I moved here?
Who asked you to move here?
Who asked you?
Who were you
walking?
Back where you came from.
Spix. Mick.
What?
Before George Takaris was cast in the film as the leader of the Sharks, he starred in the London production of the show in the role of Riff, the leader of the Jets. Takaris is of Greek descent. I asked him what he had to do to make himself appear Puerto Rican for the film.
Well, one of the things they did to us, I'm very pale as a person, so they darkened us, of course, considerably. In fact, I remember when we started shooting the prologue, the very first take out on the streets of New York there, Jerry had them come up and say, no, I think he needs to be a little darker, so they made me darker still. So that was one thing that certainly had to be done. And the other thing was the accent, which I think was subtle, I hope anyway. And as I recall, we took Rita as our guide, so to speak, to make sure that we were sort of on track with that.
Well, one of the glorious and silliest things about West Side Stories is the singing and dancing gang members. What did Jerome Robbins tell you about the choreography and the kind of choreography he wanted for the gang members, and why would they be dancing in the street?
Well, it was a musical.
Exactly. A compelling reason.
But one of the things that I think Jerry did so brilliantly, and he was, God knows, a brilliant man, and I think genius is not an overblown word to use very directly in describing Jerry. But the way the movement is introduced in the prologue of the film, when you first start to see guys dance on the streets of New York, you know, it's done with a very subtle kind of move, and which is not really a dance move. And then there's another move, you know. And
yeah, what's happening is that the Jets are walking along the street.
Right.
And one of them will kind of like jump up in a dancerly move and then keep walking.
Or just put his arms out.
Yeah, or just put his arms out.
Very subtle stuff that eventually explodes, if you like, into dance.
Exactly.
But we're introduced to it, I think, in a way that allows us, at least I think, to accept it, mm-hmm. And not think, oh my God, don't they look silly dancing in the street?
You know, right.
The theater version started the same way. Well, in the sense that they don't start dancing right off the bat, they build up to it. And again, that building up allows it to, quote-unquote, explode into the way they feel about their turf and the way they own the street and how the street feels to them and the neighborhood feels to them. It's theirs.
Now, you actually shot the movie version of West Side Story on the streets of New York, yes?
Right. 68th and Amsterdam was one of the locations. That's where Lincoln Center now stands. And the other location was a playground, which is still there, 110th Street and 2nd Avenue. Those were the two locations.
Let's talk about the rumble scene. And this is the scene where the two gangs rumble in a schoolyard. And it's like part dance and part a choreographed fight.
Right,
but there's more
right.
dance in it than your average choreographed fight in an action
yes.
film.
Mm-hmm.
So everything in it is really quite stylized. Can you talk a little bit about the choreography of it and learning it and what it's like to stab and to be stabbed in this in this choreographed kind of way?
Yeah. You know, what I'd like to go back to in answering your question was doing the theater version of the rumble, because of course we had to do it 8 times a week. I would say it was staged rather than choreographed, because there are no dance moves per se really in the rumble. There are moves that make sense for a knife fight. And I remember, you don't really notice this particular move, which I thought was such a wonderful move. You don't notice it as well, I think, in the film, as I remember the way it felt, at least in the stage version. And I, as Riff, had to do this to Bernardo in the stage version. It's hard to describe, but I run toward him. I sort of invert myself, and I get a scissor kind of grip with my legs around his legs, and I bring him down to his knees and then bring up the knife like I'm going to stab him, and then somebody pulls me off. But these were kind of gymnastic things, if you like, although I'm not a gymnast at all. But again, I think the difference in the rumble is it's staged, but I would not say it's choreographed, because there are not dance moves in it.
Did the actors playing the members of the rival gangs, the Jets and the Sharks, mingle on the set, or were you advised to keep separately, as if you really were Jets and Sharks?
It wasn't the same as the theater version. Now, I think in the theater version, although, I was not there for the creation of it, Jerry Robbins made it clear on the first day of rehearsal that he wanted the Sharks to stay over there, the Jets to stay over there, not have lunch together, not socialize with each other. He encouraged what he really needed was to create the tension and the danger that is vital to the piece. So that was very much there, even for us when we were recreating the piece for the London production. When it came time to the movie, he absolutely wanted that same tension and danger, but he eased up on that particular aspect, but it was still there.
Was it helpful in the London cast to keep the Jets and Sharks separate? Was that helpful to you?
It was, and I think one of the reasons it was, I have seen productions of West Side Story, not many, in the theater, where the danger is not there. And I think Jerry's means of getting that danger there, that is by keeping us separate, definitely did help. I had never acted in my life. I'd been a chorus dancer. I mean, I wanted to be an actor. I just didn't know how to get there. So it was helpful, and it also it made us go further in our own imaginations as to how to keep that feeling alive on the stage. And being younger people, I think Jerry, this was like cutting to the chase. You know, he knew how to make it happen.
Now, I've read that some of the actors who tested for parts in the film adaptation of West Side Story include Tony Perkins, Warren Beatty, Bobby Darin, Burt Reynolds, Richard Chamberlain, and Troy Donahue.
And Robert Redford.
And Robert Redford, really,
yeah,
for which part?
I heard that. I don't know, but I know I've heard that. I don't know if I heard it from Bob Wise, but I think so.
Did you know that all those other people had tested?
Had no idea at all, no. And again, going back to this thing when we were doing it at the theater, never dreaming you'd get, it just never entered our minds that we'd ever be part of this. It was a tremendous thrill and surprise, because we were getting news from Los Angeles about, you know, big stars testing, or not testing, but being considered. I think two of the names that I remember hearing, I think I'm correct, one was Elizabeth Taylor and one was Elvis Presley. I don't know if those were in fact real considerations or not. It was just part of the bits of things in newspapers that would be put on the bulletin board for us to see at the stage door.
Now, you won an Academy Award for your performance as Bernardo. How did it change your career to get the Academy Award?
Well, before that, I didn't have a career. I mean, I was doing well enough, I suppose, really. But what it did was it opened doors for the remainder, and it still does, oddly enough, it still does. But it changed everything for me, certainly.
Were you typecast as Puerto Rican after West Side Story, even though you're not Puerto Rican?
Yes, I was. You know, the two things, the only time I ever worked in Los Angeles on anything was West Side Story. Every other film I made, anything else that I did was always somewhere else. It was in England, it was in France, it was in Italy, Australia. I never got to work in the States again. But, you know, there were the guest appearances on, you know, things like Murder, She Wrote that many of us did. And the ones that always came up for me, and I chose not to do them, I would always be offered the part of someone who was Latin, or someone who was a choreographer. So they couldn't get away from the Puerto Rican dancing thing, you know, for me. So I was typecast, but thank God there were other places to go.
George Chakiris won an Oscar for his performance as Bernardo in the film West Side Story. Coming up, we meet Rita Moreno, who played his girlfriend, Anita. This is Fresh Air. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the film West Side Story. My guests are Rita Moreno and Marnie Nixon. Nixon dubbed Natalie Wood's singing part in West Side Story. Nixon also did the singing for Deborah Carr in the film The King and I. Rita Moreno won an Oscar for her performance as Anita, the girlfriend of Bernardo, the leader of the Puerto Rican gang The Sharks. Moreno now is one of the stars of the HBO prison series Oz. She was one of the few actors in the film West Side Story who played a Puerto Rican and was actually from Puerto Rico.
The reason was that there simply weren't enough Hispanic, forget Puerto Rican, Hispanic male and female dancers at the time who could do the kind of professional job that was needed for Jerome Robbins's choreography, which is, you might have noticed, extremely complex and very difficult. There just weren't any. The reason there weren't any, I am surmising, is that a lot of Latin kids, Latino kids in those days, didn't have the money to take those kind of classes. They were a lot like, in a way, like the street dancers of years later, the kids who danced on their backs and all that kind of stuff, who had talent but didn't have the training. So as a result, the Sharks, there were just a few of us, really, who were truly Latino, who were able to get the part.
Did you have to do anything to look more, act more, or sound more Puerto Rican?
They made me use an accent, which I wasn't thrilled about because a lot of us obviously don't have them. The thing that really bothered me the most is that they put the same very muddy, dark-colored makeup on every shark girl and boy, and that really made me very upset. And I tried to get that changed, and I said, look at us. We're all, you know, many, many different colors. Some of us are very white. Some of us are olive-skinned. Some of us actually have black blood. Some of us are Taino Indian, which is the original Puerto Rican. And nobody paid attention, and that was that. I had no choice in the matter, but I was not happy. And when I saw the film recently and saw George Takiris, this beautiful guy, Greek guy, who looked like he had fallen into a bucket of mud, I started to giggle.
Now, Marni Nixon, you dubbed the singing for Natalie Wood. Did she know when she got the part that she was going to be dubbed, that she wouldn't be singing herself?
No, I think the problem always during the picture was that I think it was very unclear that she didn't know how much of her voice could be used. They didn't tell her that gradually, I guess as they worked with her, that maybe it wasn't going to be good enough because they were afraid to upset her. And it created an atmosphere of... I felt very uneasy. And when we recorded the songs, actually, we recorded them. They said they were going to record them with her doing the complete songs, with maybe there were combinations of me doing the high notes within those complete recordings of hers. And then they would record me doing the complete songs. And then they said they were going to combine those electronically later on, which I knew was not really possible to do. I think they created a monster, really, in her because she would listen to her takes, and she didn't know. It's very hard to know whether you're good or bad if not really being a singer in these huge speakers that magnify any kind of discrepancy. And anyway, and they would tell her afterwards, "Oh, Natalie, it is just wonderful, absolutely wonderful." And then they would turn to me and wink. And I just felt like I wanted to cringe.
What did you think of her takes? Did you think her singing was good? Did you think it needed to be dubbed?
Well, you know, I can't even remember, except that I knew that they probably would all have to be thrown out. I think what happens is that when you're not really trained in music theater or in opera, that you can sing your own things in your own tempo and your own songs and in your own way, in your own key. But when you're doing a Bernstein score, it's written like an opera. I mean, you have to have the rhythm exactly right. And she had to acquire an accent, which then I had to try to acquire because I had to be her.
I heard her recordings. Because... well, we all had to have stuff like that at home, and actually, she had a very bad voice. She wasn't a singer.
Right.
And it's not even fair to judge her on her singing because she wasn't a singer. She maintained and obviously insisted that she at least get first crack at it, which I suppose is fair. I think what was terrible is what Marni just related.
Yes, that, it's terrible.
She would finish a take, and they'd carry on as though... Amelita Gallicurchi had just, come back. That's dreadful.
So what was her reaction when she was told, well, it's going to be dubbed by Marni Nixon, your voice isn't going to be used in the songs?
Well, I think from what I've heard, now, this is only secondhand. I only heard it through the musical powers that be, and they said that she was just absolutely furious and stomped out of the studio in a total rage. But I guess they knew that that would happen, or anyway, there was nothing she could do about it legally. So then, actually, I never really saw her after that, except months later after the picture had been released. So I didn't have any relationship with her after that, so I never knew, and she certainly didn't take it out on me.
Rita Moreno, do you remember Natalie Wood's reaction when she found out that she was being dubbed?
Only what I heard, which was that she was deeply, deeply disappointed. Yeah. And it's certainly understandable given the way in which they handled it. I think she really believed it was going to be her voice, mostly her voice, with Marnie doing, as she says, the tough notes, the hard notes, the long notes. And it must have been horrible for her. It's so unfair. And I'm no fan of hers, but I don't think... I think they dealt with it very, very poorly.
You're not a fan of hers?
No, I don't think she was right for the role. She didn't think she was right for the role. It's one of the reasons that she was not terribly friendly to the cast, and not because she was never, ever rude. Let me make that very clear. But she was aloof. And the reason I realize now that she was so aloof is that she felt so out of her element, which indeed she was. But the cast took it in a different way. And it's a shame because it made for a surprising amount of walking on eggs and tension around the set. I mean, I can't say it was horribly stressed. We had a terrific time. But there was always one person missing, and that was Natalie.
Rita Moreno and Marnie Nixon will be back in the second half of the show as we continue our 40th anniversary tribute to the film West Side Story. The film will be shown on Turner Classic Movies Saturday night, along with interviews with some of the film's stars. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
America. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our 40th anniversary celebration of the film West Side Story with Rita Moreno, who won an Oscar for her performance as Anita, and Marnie Nixon, who dubbed the singing for Natalie Wood. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the lyrics of our national anthem. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Rita Moreno and Marnie Nixon. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the film West Side Story. Rita Moreno won an Oscar for her performance as Anita, the girlfriend of the leader of the Puerto Rican gang, the Sharks. Marnie Nixon dubbed the singing voice for Natalie Wood. Wood played Maria, a Puerto Rican girl who falls in love with a former member of the white gang, the Jets. When Natalie Wood was making the movie, she sang her part and didn't know that her songs would later be overdubbed.
Well, Marnie Nixon, when you were doing the singing, it must have been complicated, since Natalie Wood thought she was singing for real. You know, she was lip-syncing to her own
recording. And then did you have to sing in such a way as to match her lip movements?
Well, that's usually the process, is that it's always the actress that has to come in and has the job of mouthing to her track or anybody's track. And so when she had filmed it to her track, the problem was also that she wasn't in sync with her own track. And I said, well, how am I supposed to fix it up if her lips are already not in sync with the orchestra? And they said, well, you figure out a way. And so that's the hardest way. I mean, it's so much better if it's pre-recorded and decided, and then she has to do it, and then maybe you just fix up a few little spots. But this was in every single song, practically.
It's also a question of feeling, how that person feels when they're singing those particular lines.
Yes.
I was not able to sing A Boy Like That. I was dubbed by another person for A Boy Like That for a very simple reason, not because I can't sing, but because at the time I was practically a coloratura, which is a very, very high, rangy voice, and I could not, for the life of me, and believe me, I tried, I could not reach the low notes in the beginning of the song, which starts, A boy like that who kill your brother, and then it goes up very high to very smart, Maria, very smart. And I couldn't reach those low notes. So they finally said, well, we're going to have to find somebody for you, which, of course, broke my heart. And they brought in a woman named, at the time a girl, named Betty Wand, who sang for me. And let me tell you how difficult that is. I sat in the control room trying to tell her, because I started this conversation about feeling, how Anita was feeling at that time. But Betty Wand was a singer. She was not an actress who sang. And she just couldn't get it the way I wanted it.
Oh, that's terrible.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because I wanted to sound, it should have almost been a growl, a boy like that, you know, barely sung. And she ended up sounding, and whenever I hear it, my stomach knots up, because she sounded almost like a cliche Mexican. She was going, a boy like that, who'll kill your brother. I wouldn't dream of ever singing the song that way. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not making fun of her. That's the only thing she was able to do, and no one was able to help her, even though I was there, to do it any differently, because we must have done take after take after take after take, trying to get her to do it the way I wanted it done, and the way, you know, it should have been done.
Well, Rita Moreno, what was it like for you to be singing this duet, knowing you were being dubbed by somebody whose performance you didn't really like, singing this duet with Natalie Wood, because she's singing I Have a Love and It's All That I Have, right or wrong, what else can I do? And she's being dubbed, and she doesn't know she's being dubbed. So, you know, what a kind of odd circumstance to be doing this. Just to clarify what's happening in the scene for listeners who might not have seen the movie, Natalie Wood, Maria's boyfriend, Tony, has just killed Anita's boyfriend at a rumble. And he didn't mean to do it, he didn't want to do it, but he did it to revenge the murder of his best friend. And so Anita, you, Rita Moreno, as Anita, mm-hmm. is saying, you know, a boy like that who killed your brother, you know, how can you be in love with him? And Natalie Wood is saying, I have a love and it's all that I have. So that's...
But Anita's not only saying that, she understands when she comes into the bedroom that this girl, Maria, who was a virgin till then,
right,
has slept with her boyfriend's murderer, because she runs to the window, looks out, Anita does, and sees him running away from the building. So it's just so many things going on, not only that she just found out that Bernardo has been killed by Tony, but that Maria of all people, has just bedded with this young man.
Marty Nixon, you dubbed Natalie Wood's part on this duet. What's your experience of this duet?
You know, I have no recollection, except it might have been one of the duets that, and maybe Rita would know, that was planned for me to do all along. So maybe she was singing to my voice during the filming. I've forgotten that.
You know what? You know what, Marnie? I think your voice was on that one, because if it
I think it was all me.
Because if it had been Natalie, it would have been even more difficult to do.
Well, I don't think that. Come to think of it, I don't think she could have even stretched into that. I think it was just the musical directors approved of it. I think I heard her sing it in the rehearsal studio, and got a feeling of what it was supposed to be, and then I just recorded it, and then she had to approve of that, and I don't know, I guess she did, because I don't think we had to take it over, but well, it really wasn't in a duet form. I mean, I never saw Rita in the recording studio at all, so we didn't really do a duet together.
Well, now I have to play this duet that we've been talking so much about.
So now you're going to hear a very Mexican girl.
Right. So imagine on screen we're seeing Natalie Wood and Rita Moreno, but what we're hearing in this duet is Marnie Nixon and Betty Wand.
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another. One of your own. Stick to your own kind. A boy like that will give you sorrow. You'll meet another boy tomorrow. One of your own kind. Stick to your own kind. A boy who kills cannot love. A boy who kills has no heart. And he's the boy who gets your love and gets your heart. A boy like that wants one thing only, and when he's done, he'll leave you lonely. He'll murder your love, he murdered mine. Just wait and see, just wait, Maria, just wait and see.
Oh, no, Anita, no, Anita, no. It isn't true, not for me, it's true for you, not for me. Or so you said, you should know better. I have a love and it's all that I have, right or wrong.
A duet from West Side Story with the voices of Betty Wand and Marnie Nixon. And my guests are Rita Moreno and Marnie Nixon. Marnie Nixon did the dubbing for Natalie Wood. Rita Moreno played Anita in the movie. I'm wondering, after the movie was shot, did Natalie Wood not want anyone to know that you, Marnie Nixon, had dubbed her voice? And how did you feel about how much credit you should get? And then Rita Moreno, I'm wondering how you felt about people finding out that in one song, in your duet, that your voice was dubbed. Did you not want people to know that?
Well, I'll tell you, no, I didn't want them to know. At the time, I was very, very so embarrassed, because it sort of seemed to cast a shadow on the rest of the stuff that I did sing. And I got over that. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But I'll tell you what is disconcerting, and I'm going to find out about it soon. Apparently, I think it's Columbia Records, has Betty Wand's name on all of the stuff that I did, too. And that's that's made me very, very unhappy.
My guests are Rita Moreno and Marnie Nixon. We'll talk more about West Side Story after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
It's the 40th anniversary of the film West Side Story. My guests are Rita Moreno, who won an Oscar for her performance as Anita, and Marnie Nixon, who dubbed the songs for Natalie Wood. Rita yeah. Moreno, I want to ask you about another scene. Mm-hmm. There's a scene toward the end of the movie, after your boyfriend Bernardo has been stabbed. Maria, the Natalie Wood character, asks you to send a message to her boyfriend, Tony. Mm-hmm. And this is right after the I Have a Love duet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so you go to...
the candy store.
To the candy store to give a message to the owner there. And all the Jets are hanging out there. Mm-hmm. And they start taunting you. And the implication is that they've raped you, too. I think that's the implication.
Yes,
yeah.
If it had been done a few years ago, that's what would have happened.
Right. But it's all kind of stylized and choreographed. Can you talk about that scene?
Gee, I'm glad you brought that up because that was a seminal scene for me. Some interesting and personal emotional pond scum came to the surface. We rehearsed that number for, as we did with everything in that movie, for weeks. And then we got to the shooting, which took about 7 days. And at some point, having the boys constantly cursing me out and throwing me around and calling me things like spick and garlic mouth and a pierced ear apparently opened up some wounds that I thought had been healed years and years and years before then. And I remember that at that point, and I think it was in the middle of shooting this, some part of that scene, I stopped and I sat down at the stool at the candy counter, put my head on my arms, and started to sob and cry, and I could not stop. I must have cried for about 45 minutes, and just there was no consoling me. I was inconsolable. And it's funny, as I speak of it, I start getting tears in my eyes. And the boys came to me and say, "Oh, Rita, please, you know we love you. You know we love you. Please don't cry. Please stop. Oh, the audience is going to hate us." And I couldn't stop. And finally, Bob Wise called lunch. And, you know, I calmed down, obviously, after lunch, and we got it all done. But there is a huge piece of my soul in that scene. It's all of the terrible things that happened to me. Not like that, but it was symbolic of all of the terrible things that have that happened to me when I was younger, that apparently just inundated my soul and seared my soul. And I was as surprised as anybody.
When you were able to start shooting the film again, do you feel like that personal connection deepened your performance, or did it get in the way of it because it was so upsetting?
No, it didn't get in the way. I think it deepened it. And by the time we got to the part of the scene where the Doc, the candy store owner, comes in and stops the rape, the symbolic rape, and I go to the door and say, "Don't you touch me," because I think they were saying something like, "Don't let her get away." And somebody puts their hand on my shoulder, and I turn around and say, "Don't you touch me." Wow. That was filled with every terrible anger that I have ever experienced in my life, that line. It didn't get in the way.
Can you talk a little bit about the choreography that Jerry Robbins worked out for the rape scene?
Jerry had an ability, which is rare, even now, to choreograph for character. In other words, any step that Anita might do, say, in America or in the Mambo at the gym, was not a step that he would ever have dreamed of giving to some other character on the other side, for instance, to the Jet, a Jet girl. And he worked that out with us. He was a meticulous, crazy man. He was meticulous with respect to what he wanted. The problem was he didn't always know exactly what he wanted. He just wanted it to be perfect. And Jerry had several versions of each section of each dance. So that, for instance, if you were rehearsing America with him, he would, after you did
one version would say, okay, now let me see version B of section two. So you were really learning anywhere from two to three other dances beside the original one. That's how he worked. And he would watch it and watch it and watch it and then say, okay, now let me go back to section one and do version A of that. He wanted to get the very best he could out of each section of these dances. Mm-hmm. And that's how the rape scene also happened. It was a question of throwing me around, and when they would throw me around, when someone would grab my blouse to try to tear it off, when somebody would lift up my skirts to humiliate me, all that kind of stuff was very, very planned.
Any thoughts on the fact that the 40th anniversary of West Side Story, shot on location in Manhattan, coincides with the transformation of Manhattan after the World Trade Center attacks?
Oh, I'd like to say that one of the thrills was seeing that opening shot of the skyline of New York City pre-World Trade Center, and having the audience suddenly, the relevancy of where we were at that moment and of seeing New York in its this wonderful helicopter shot, and having people suddenly burst into applause of cheers, that really it was about the relevancy of the story, and but the relevancy of here we are here, and all of the current thoughts were piled on top of that. That, to me, was exciting also.
It was immensely resonant. It was really, the audience just went crazy with that opening shot.
Because this was at the Radio City
Radio City Music Hall
40th anniversary screening. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was amazing because it was a Manhattan they wanted desperately to see.
Right. Well, thank you so much for giving us West Side Story. It's such a wonderful film. And thank you so much for your performances, and thank you for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
It's been a treat.
Rita Moreno won an Oscar for her performance as Anita in West Side Story. Marnie Nixon dubbed the songs for Natalie Wood. Turner Classic Movies will celebrate the 40th anniversary of the film Saturday night. They'll show the film and feature interviews with some of the stars.
Gonna get her kicks tonight. We'll have our private little mix tonight. He'll walk in hot and tired, poor dear. Don't matter if he's tired, as long as he's here.
Tonight won't be just any night. Tonight there will be no morning star. Tonight, I'll see my love tonight, and for us, stars will stop where they are.
Morning, the minutes in my gold, the hours go so slowly, and still the sky is light. Oh, moon, grow bright, and make this endless day.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the lyrics of the national anthem. This is Fresh Air. The burst of patriotism following the September 11th attacks has everybody rethinking the significance of American symbols, particularly the Star Spangled Banner. Some people say the song is too militaristic. A school board in Madison, Wisconsin, instructed schools to use only an instrumental version. And just about everybody complains that the song is too hard to sing. But our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, isn't sure about the alternatives.
If you ask me, the Star Spangled Banner has gotten a bad rap. After all, those rockets and bombs were coming from the British ships that were bombarding Fort McHenry as Francis Scott Key watched helplessly from the harbor. The song celebrates America surviving a foreign attack, not launching one. Even so, I can understand why some people would as soon have an anthem with no war images at all. And the Star Spangled Banner does have insurmountable musical deficiencies. It's fun to cheer at a baseball game when a performer hits the high note on Land of the Free. But anthems ought to be songs that everybody can sing in unison without requiring throat surgery afterwards. The reconsideration of the anthem has been in the air for a while. We seem to redefine our national symbols every 100 years or so. Most of the present apparatus of American patriotism was put in place around the turn of the 20th century. The Pledge of Allegiance was composed in 1892 by Francis Bellamy, a Boston socialist and Baptist minister. Actually, Bellamy had originally proposed having the pledge end with liberty, justice, and equality for all, but that was unacceptable to members of the Massachusetts Education Board who were opposed to giving women the vote. And it wasn't until 1916 that President Wilson issued an executive order that made the Star Spangled Banner our official national anthem, around the same time he proclaimed Flag Day a national holiday. In any case, people seem to feel it's time for a change. During the last few weeks of the Major League season, baseball teams were playing God Bless America at the seventh inning stretch, and a lot of people were treating it as if it were a real anthem, standing and removing their hats. I've always liked that song, particularly when I imagine the setting that Irving Berlin intended it for when he composed it in 1918, a Ziegfeld-style production number for an all-soldier musical review called Yip Yip Yap Hank. The song became famous in 1939 when Kate Smith recorded it with lush strings and brass. It's certainly the catchiest of all the contenders, and it would be fitting for America to have an anthem written on Tin Pan Alley. But we're not ready for that yet. The clear front runner for an anthem replacement is America the Beautiful, written back in 1893 by a Wellesley professor named Catherine Lee Bates. Willie Nelson closed the All-Star TV benefit on September 22nd by leading everybody in singing the song. And ABC News correspondent Lynn Scherr has a new book high on the bestseller lists with the title America the Beautiful, The Stirring True Story Behind Our Nation's Favorite Song. No question, it is a likable song. It may not be stirring like Battle Hymn of the Republic, which is the only patriotic song that America's produced that could go elbow to elbow with the Marseillaise and Deutschland über alles if it came to a showdown in Rick's Cafe. But America the Beautiful is a sweet little tune, particularly when Ray Charles sings it. And it's a song you can join in on without self-consciousness. I can understand the appeal of the lyrics, too. It's partly that call for coast-to-coast brotherhood, but mostly it's those pretty landscape pictures, like a set of old chromolithograph postcards. But I'm troubled about the idea of making the song our national anthem. Maybe it's the overblown language with its contorted syntax and fulsome descriptions. You have to be wary of any verses that have that many adjectives in them, particularly adjectives like spacious, amber, purple, and fruited. If we have to have adjectives, I'll take free and brave. This isn't just a stylistic quibble. That overwriting is a symptom of the late 19th century sentimentalism about a vanishing rural America. It's easy for modern Americans to sympathize with that, given our own concerns about the threatened environment. But it puts the essence of the country far from the daily lives that most of us live. When I was a kid in Manhattan, I remember singing about purple mountains and waves of grain and thinking that America must be a distant place somewhere out beyond New Jersey. And the sublime landscape of the song doesn't have any more to do with the country that most of us inhabit now, a land of spacious parking lots and amber traffic signals. Of course, we all love purple mountains, even if we aren't all fortunate enough to see them out of our kitchen windows. But there's something reductive about making our landscape the focus of our anthem. Any country can do that. The Swiss sing about the Alps going bright with splendor. The Czechs sing about water bubbling across the meadows and pine woods rustling amongst the crags. The Brazilians sing about the sound of the sea and the light of heaven. And the Syrian anthem begins with a remarkable entomological trope. Syria's plains are towers in the heights, a land resplendent with brilliant suns, almost like a sky centipede. Anthems like that are particularly convenient for nations that change their form of government every so often. Landscapes don't have any politics. But the American experiment was supposed to be different. Our patriotism is about a nation, not a land. No other country tells its story as the history of a single regime. And some of that ought to be up front in the anthem we sing. I had a similar reaction to the administration's choice of the words homeland security rather than domestic security to describe the new office headed by Governor Ridge. I understand what they were getting at, given the shock of the attack on American soil. But even though homeland is a perfectly good English word, up to now we've never used it to describe our own country. It has an alien sound, like the German word Heimat. It's the word we use for peoples who feel an ancestral connection to a particular plot of ground. Whereas the idea of America isn't that it's a place that people come from, but a place that they come to. The Germans and Kurds and Ukrainians have homelands. We just have a nation and a flag.
Jeffrey Nunberg is the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now, Commentaries on Language and Culture. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. We're listening to Irving Berlin. I'm Terry Gross.
To the prairies, to the oceans, white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From PBS, this week Frontline follows the trail of a convicted terrorist, from his motives to his methods. Local times may vary. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Albert Brooks, the comic, writer, actor, and director, stars in the new film My First Mister. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.